For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. So glad you could join us. I'm joined today by Tim Miller. He's an MSNBC political analyst and colleague over there and a writer at large at The Bulwark. He was also communications director for Jeb Bush's 2016 presidential campaign and a spokesman for the Republican National Committee, something we both know a little bit about. So we're excited to have you join us for this conversation where we dissect the elements of the disease and the delusions of the once proud men and women who called themselves Republicans, and get into his new book, Why We Did It, which is out now. It's a travelogue, as he puts it, a travelogue from the Republican road to hell. You can't get any better than that right here on the Michael Steele Podcast coming up next. Well, I told folks that you were coming on, Tim, and I have to tell you, man, I was like, oh, I can't wait to hear this conversation.
My fangirls were starting
fangirls, baby. And look, I count myself among them. Welcome, man. It's great to have you in the house.
Dude, it's so good to be with you. Good day for it.
Now, so I have two disappointments, one related to the book and the other related to this interview.
Okay.
The one related to the book is that you didn't call a brother to share some thoughts about some of these assholes you were writing about. Okay.
I believe we had a brief talk about the Little Mix.
We had a brief talk about the Little Mix.
But maybe I could have gotten some more intel on some of the other characters.
No, I'm just kidding you. And the second is, where are my pearls?
Oh, right now in the convo? Yeah,
where are my pearls, baby?
Sorry. You know, it's early out here. I like to keep the pearls on afternoon. You know, I put on the pearls afternoon.
Well, it's great having you, man. This is, I have to tell folks again about this book that's different. It's titled Why We Did It. And it's different from what's been out on the street, because unlike the other books that have kind of gone into these grand scenarios and tell these sweeping stories and you know, kind of give you sort of a, you know, broad 360, 10,000 foot level view of what was happening during this period, Why We Did It is like a microscope. It singles out individual actors, and it tries to help us better understand contextually why things happen the way they happen. In fact, you open up in the introduction, you say, quote, Why We Did It is a book about the people who submitted to every whim of a comically unfit and detestable man who crapped all over them and took over the party they had given their life to. It's about the army of consultants, politicians, and media figures who stood back and stood by as everything they ever fought for was degraded and devalued. The people who privately admitted they recognized all the risks, but still climbed aboard for a ride on the SS Trump-held ship that they knew would assuredly sink. That, for me, when I read that opening, I was like, finally, we're going to get a microscope up the ass of these individuals. And you did. Tell us. So I guess the one thing that struck me about you, the book is titled Why We Did It and not Why They Did It. Why that difference? Because you were there. You were part of that at the RNC. And so what was that journey like for you to sort of include yourself in this conversation that way?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that little prelude, Michael. And that's what I was going for. And there have just been so many great books about what happened.
Right.
But not a ton of good stuff about why people went along with it. Right. And going deep on these folks and treating them like real humans. Right. Like there is particularly books from the left, you know, it's like these are sociopaths or bigots. All right. You don't need to think about this. These are greedy monsters. And there's some greedy monsters and some bigots. OK.
Right.
But like these are humans. Right. These are multidimensional humans. And so I wanted to really grapple with and demonstrate, you know, the complex justifications that allowed them to go along with this evil. And I thought that, you know, by just making it why they did it, I'd lose some credibility with the reader because, you know, we all we might not have gone along with Donald Trump, but I used a lot of these same rationalizations that they used
in
other times, in other circumstances in my life. And like the we in the book is really this Republican political class, you know, that there's this very small number of us who bailed, an even smaller number of us who got on the ship and then bailed again, then finally bailed eventually, but we welcome them. We welcome them into the fold. I thought that I could best, you know, we only know our own motivations, right? Man, like for sure. Right. You only know your own motivations for sure. And so if I was going to really put the microscope up the ass of these ladies and guys, I wanted to put it up my own. That's maybe a little more graphic than it was meant to sound, but, you know, and explain why, like, look, I consulted for Ken Cuccinelli, man. I consulted for Ken fucking Cuccinelli. Why did I do that? He's a homophobic bigot who was Donald Trump's chief election thief. You know, right. maybe not chief, but he was in
the
cadre. Yeah. Why did I do that? And so I felt like if I could explain that, that would give me the credibility and insight to better explain why these other fools all went along.
Well, I'm not, you know, I agree with you. I'm not, I don't distance myself from that. In fact, for a lot of my time, particularly earlier in my career, you know, I very much seen and was a part of a lot of those conversations that laid out stuff. I always, though, along the way, drew that line, which is why I had so much trouble inside the party, because I figured out very early on one of the best things for them to do with me is to put me out as the black man who would give credence and credibility to their language and to their efforts. And so I refused to go down that road, which still surprises me that I was able to achieve what I was able to achieve in the process. But there is a lot of self-evaluation both then and during that process. And what I found compelling about your particular story and the narrative that you set out and the way you did it is your honesty is not just endearing, but it is infectious to the extent that you're straight up. You said, you know, you're talking about as a gay man being involved in this space in which you are, you know, in rooms and the people are out there basically planning, you know, anti-gay, homophobic narratives that you're sitting there signing off on. And in fact, early in the book, you say, and yet coming out still required me to unravel a mind fuck that was a quarter century in the making. That had to been a very, that's deep. That goes inside you in a way that makes this book that much more compelling in so many ways. When you then start taking that microscope, you first put it on yourself before you put it on others.
Yeah. No, there are two elements that I think are worth talking about. They're kind of different. One in the book, I thought talking about the gay stuff gave me credibility, right? Because I mean, shit, if I'm working for people that are trying to deny me the most important things in my life, like, okay, it becomes a lot easier to understand why people could go along with something that might just hurt immigrants at the border or whatever, right?
Right. I mean,
like, you know, so that parallel is there. I also think that the closet, there is, it's not a clean parallel, but there is this element of like coming out of the closet, changing your identity, right? Like one of the hard parts about doing that for me was, look, all my buddies that were like football bros and my family's super religious. And it's like, man, a big part of the reason that coming out of the closet was hard because it was like, well, what are they going to think about me? Like, are they, you know, what's my standing within this group going to be? it was kind of like that being an ever Trumper, right? Like it was kind of like a second, you know, coming out. Obviously there's some differences, of course, like, you know, I didn't get to choose on the first one.
Right.
But I think that a lot of folks that stuck around, the reasons that they did were kind of banal, right? It was like, oh man, if I do what Michael and Tim did, then, you know, I'm not gonna be invited to the parties anymore. Like my little friend group that we have poker night, like right. I'm gonna be ostracized, right? I'm gonna have to find a new job, right? There's this identity changing element to it, and so I thought that was worth exploring. And I'm interested in your view. I guess I'll be the interview host for a second here.
Sure,
but like,
sure.
But it's funny you say that about being the black man and being put forth, because I write about in this book with Reince in particular, with your successor, he tried to get me to stay at the RNC for this reason around gay marriage. And I'm not very nice to Reince in the book, but to his credit on this, you know, he was always, you know, he hired me as a spokesperson and took a little shit from the Christians. I was out by the time and he took it. So I always give him a little credit for that. But he basically was like arguing, you know, well, when the gay marriage gets overturned, like we're going to need a reasonable gay in the room, you know, to kind of like put out there, right? Like to kind of put out there, I could put you out there. Yep. You can help make sure our language is a little nicer. There is a little bit of a parallel between that. And I was like, nah, I don't know. I'm not up for that. But it's funny like that. I'm wondering, I do feel like that experience was probably similar to how
absolutely. Oh my God. I cannot begin to tell you the number of times, even as the national chairman, that I would sit in these meetings with Reince and with other leaders, and they would be, you know, talking around race, but you know, you could see they were comforted by the fact, well, we had a black guy that could go out there and clean this shit up.
Right.
And the problem was I wouldn't do that. And I remember one conversation we had, they'd given me this press release about Barack Obama. And it was going off on all this shit about his birth certificate and all of this stuff. And I looked at everybody in the room and said, y'all know I'm black, right? I can't go to the Starbucks in my neighborhood tomorrow morning if I put this shit out. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, and I tell the story, the day I got elected, Tim, I'm walking back into the hall after doing an interview. And one of the 168 members of the RNC comes out, and she, you know, I've known her a long time, very excited. She gives me the big hug and she looks at me and she goes, and now blacks will join the Republican Party. And I looked at her and I go, I'm not a Pied Piper. You know, but so you had this mindset inside the party, and which is really interesting, because when you look at it from a legacy perspective, we had log cabin Republicans going back to the late 1950s and 1960s who struck that space, carved out that space within the party for gay and lesbian Americans who were Republicans, and built with some difficulty, or because I worked with the log cabins going back to when I was a county chairman here in Prince George's, and even when I was growing up in DC. So it's not like a gay Republican was something unusual or out of space, just like black Republicans. And yet,
yeah, but it was unusual in that building, though. I don't, you know,
that's,
it was unusual
and
in
that's
that
the difference. And no, that's see, the
and
difference.
And I do wonder, like, do you look back at that? Because I do. I read this book with a little bit of, man, maybe I should have known better, just a little bit, but like because of those conversations, right? I wrote about this. I look back at, like, I'm at the RNC. I don't know. What was that restaurant right next to the people we used to go to? I'm blanking on it. They had these great little shakes. They had these little comfort shakes. It was like, I would get a Captain Crunch shake right across the street from the RNC. And that Windsor Supreme Court hearing ruling comes down. And we had to put out a press release. And I don't know. I was looking at that press release like you were looking at the birth certificate one. And I was like, man, you know, I did my best.
Was it Tortilla Coast? Was that
no this one? Bull feathers.
I was gonna say tortilla or bull feathers.
Bull feathers. So then I helped make the press release a little less bad than it would have been, and then just walked over to Bull Feathers, sat back in the lone of the Bull Feathers by myself, and ate a Captain Crunch shake, and was going, man, I should be at the gay bar right now with my pals, like celebrating, like this. We overturned DOMA. And so I do look back at that and think, man, I really there was some pretty grody stuff. I think I was just blocking out a little bit. I don't know. What do you feel that way at all? Or
No, I leaned more into it. I kind of rationalized. All right, I'll use it.
Yeah, sure.
I'll use it. You know, okay, I know why I'm in the room. And once the problem, you know, Ranks can tell you, if he's honest, will tell you that the problem Ranks had, and ultimately what made it easier for him to come after me, was I was very honest with him. I mean, I can wax for hours the level of friendship I developed with this punk.
Yeah.
And to my, and I put blinders on, and I shouldn't have, but you strike, when we talk about that chapter in the book, the little mix, which I thought should have been minx, but that's another conversation. you know, he used all of that in, you know, to his ultimate advantage, but I was very straightforward about, this is who I am. And, you know, y'all knew, I mean, the thing that killed me about the Republican National Committee, it wasn't like I was an unknown. They knew me from back when I was a county chairman in 1994. Right. And when I was a state chairman in 2000. So I had a long history. I served on the executive committee when I was state chairman. You know, Jim Gilmore appointed me to the executive. I was the first Black on the executive committee. So, yeah. So they knew who I was. It wasn't like, oh, Michael Steele's this unknown quantity and we don't know where his politics are. They knew I was a conservative, but I talk like a Democrat because I'd learned my politics from Democrats. I know how to use the language of the street and all that stuff. And so I never worried too much about that aspect of it. I just figured I'd just use it. And they didn't like that. And yeah, I probably could maybe use it a little bit more wisely at times.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do get to a point, Tim, where you're like a bull in the china shop. And I get the sense from you in this book that there were points where you reached that, when you talk about the breakup, when you talk about various aspects of this, where you were like, fuck it.
Yeah, for sure. And this is, I guess this is why I say I look back and it's like, man, I was like, fuck it by 2015.
Right.
You know, and there were times, you know, there were moments in 2012, 2013. I was not exactly Mr. Go Along to Get Along at the RNC, of course, in 2012, like in 2013. But you know, I just look back at it and say, man, I could have been maybe a little bit more of a bull. Or, you know, like maybe there were things that were a little bit, you know, that there was some subtext or some language, you know, some ways we could have been more explicit in challenging, you know, this go along to get along kind of element of being in a national committee. But no, by 2015, I was like, this is crazy. I feel like it's the Zoolander. Like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Like, you guys are all really going along with this. I know, two examples in the book, and the Reince, a lot of Reince chapter in this talk, which is fun. I'm sure he'll enjoy this podcast. But you know, I grab him after there's that debate. Everybody remembers the Rubio debate where he talks about Trump having a little dick. Okay. Yeah. But there was one more after that where he was in. And his numbers are still they didn't bounce after the hands debate, right? And Rubio basically submits to Trump, like he doesn't go after him. It's the last debate between the Florida primary, and Rubio just says, "I'm just going to take the high road." And I'm sitting there in the audience going, "Okay, this is a concession. Like the establishment has conceded tonight."
Yeah.
And so that night we're in the South Beach at some one of these donor confabs. You've been to a million of them, and I grabbed Reince away from the Cougars and the rich guys and all that. And I was like, brother, you got to get out of there. I was like, I was like, you don't know what's coming. I was like, we know it's bad. You know it's bad. I know it's bad, but you don't know what kind of bad, and you're going to be complicit in all this. And he just couldn't get there. You know, he just wanted to be around
the guy who he had that Hamiltonian, you know, I want to be in the room. Yeah.
I want to be in the room where it happened, man. I want to be in the room where it happens. I'm going to keep doing it. But he promised me, he's like, if things go too far, I'm going to quit. And I looked at him, I was like, no, you're not. This is your chance. It's now or never. Because once you're in the room, you know, the barriers to quitting become huge. And so that happened. And then, you know, a few months later, the other example in the book is so he went and goes and does that. I went and go and do an anti-Trump pack, our principles pack.
Right.
And with it's all conservatives funded by, you know, the Ricketts family and the Singers, all these big Republican donors. And Trump wins. And a month later, all these guys want to get back in the room. They don't want to be in Dakin's good graces. So they, so in order to like apologize to Mr. Trump, they start a pro-Trump PAC.
Yes.
Future 45, the same people.
The same people.
Did the anti-PAC that was called our principles PAC. The principles was in the name of the PAC. And they call me. And they're like, hey, will you come be the spokesman for this? Because I was the spokesman for our principles PAC.
Right. Going,
is this a prank call? Like, I was like, literally, I was like, is this cranky anchors? Like, what is happening? Like, this is really happening? And I was like, no, fuck no, I'm not going to do that. Okay. But I think it was just because, again, that goes back to the gay stuff a little bit. I had been there before where right. I'd been like the lonely person where I'd pulled the plug. And I was just like, I don't need to go along to get, I don't need this. All right. And for Donald Trump, hell no. So, you know, I had a little bit of that independent streak, but that doesn't mean that I can't understand why they ended up going along, because in less high stakes, less extreme, less obvious examples, you know, I look back and some of the choices are kind of similar.
So let's unpack now as we begin to get into, because there's some interesting characters, obvious in many respects, but interesting nonetheless that you get into. So what did you conclude, or what have you concluded that are some of the main reasons, and we'll get into specifics as we go through it, but some of the main overarching reasons, which you just touched on a little bit,
yeah,
that so many of these people, you know, have just, you know, left, come back, wanted to be in the room, went after him, and then did the mea culpa, asked for forgiveness, and just stuck with this man that, as you pointed out to them on your way out the door, this does not end well. Right. Get out now, right? Yeah. I mean, this is that part of the movie when the brother's like, you know what, y'all can go on up in the house if you want to, but I'm just going to stay out here in the front yard, okay? Because it's easier for me to run from here than from inside the house.
Here's the first, I want to first just say really quick what it's not. Because the comforting thing that they like to say, our old friends like to say, is that it's the policies, you know, I just made this policy trade. And I think that for, you know, whatever, there's some ideologues out there. That's not who this book is about. Like there are some people of whom like, they're like, I'm making a deal with the devil because I just want Roe overturned, right? There are some legitimate people like that, but this book is not about that. It's about the political class. And they all want to say that it's for the policies. It wasn't for the damn policies. None of these people were hardliners. They all worked with me on the autopsy. They were all like, you know, they're money. Many of them were more moderate than you, Michael. Yeah, you know, certainly more moderate than some of the than Liz Cheney or Lisa Farah. It wasn't about look at Elise versus Liz. Like it wasn't a policy difference. It was a judgment difference. It was about morals and principles. So anyway, so that's what it's not. What is it? Different for different people. But we talked about the room where it happens. This is a drug, and there are a lot of people that were addicted to that drug being in the room where it happens. Some of it's just pure ambition, you know, pure striving, you know, wanting to get to the top, want to get the brass ring. There's money involved for some people, certainly. It was more lucrative to go that path. Yeah, and then, you know, for some, it's just this inertia, right? Like, I'm a team player, right? I'm a Republican. I've been a Republican my whole life. My identity is Republican. What am I? I'm supposed to change now? What am I supposed to do, right? So there's that element that for some people, it's like, you know, they just felt they were stuck. And the thing that surprised me the most, though, and maybe this shows my naivete, but in all those interviews, I knew. But I wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth, you know, and like really understand their calculations. The category that I didn't really expect was again, we're talking about our friends. I'm not talking about the wild-eyed, you know, crazies. Okay. Right. I know that they hate the left, you know, people that live in whatever. My friends live in Louisiana. Like, God love them. Like, we talk about football. They don't like the East Coast elites. They don't like Michael Steele, right? They don't like you, MSNBC. Right. Okay. But I'm talking about our people, the urban dwelling DC, like they fucking had grown this hatred for us, for the media, for people that are getting, you know, that were condescending, wagging their finger at them, you know, for know-it-all liberals. And it just caught me off guard how deep of a well, like for me, man, when we were sparring with the left, a lot of it was like, hey, we disagree on some of these policies. This is all in good spirits. You know, it's a little bit WWF, you know, it's a little bit of show. And, you know, we're going to go have a beer at the end of the day. For a lot of these guys, man, they had built over the Obama years just a really deep hatred of their peers, that they felt like were getting an easier deal of it. And I just didn't see that coming. And I do think it drove a lot of them into Trump's arms, I mean, because he was like this big middle finger, you know?
What was the basis of that hatred, though? I mean,
they're all rich, wealthy, privileged people. I know. I was confused by it, but it was real. There were too many examples of dudes we're five beers deep. I'm talking to them about this. And they're like, man, the media just is so easy to the left. And like, fuck those Lincoln Project guys. Now they're getting all this love. And I just, you know, my kids got to go to school and read these DEI packets. And I, you know, like Caroline chapter, she starts going off on people in their Priuses with their coexist stickers and drinking out of their paper straws. And I'm like, I don't like a paper straw, but this is pushing you to Donald Trump. Just because it's irrational doesn't mean that it wasn't real.
Well, I think it talks to me, and I certainly appreciated your breakdown of the game how you sort of set that out in the book as, you know, policy white papers doesn't add up, who cares, part of the game. Attack on your opponent isn't exactly in good faith, part of the game, make them defend it. Getting an endorsement from someone popular but repugnant, game. Raising money from people you suspect to be corrupt, game. Spam emailing supporters with hysterical messages about how their $5 is needed to prevent the evil duels from stealing everything that ever mattered to them. That is how the game is played. And so you can see how those elements of the game, and this is a chicken egg part of the conversation for me.
Okay.
Did that aspect of the game change Caroline and others? Or was the Caroline in whatever evolution in her mind, and the Reince Priebuses and the Henry Barbers, and I've got some stories about Henry Barber, how their mindset changed the game? Because one of the aspects of this, when I give talks out in the around the country from various times, I talk about how there is this very fine, thin line between human nature and the nature of politics. And, you know, there's always kind of been this sort of delicate balance where our nature sort of shapes our politics, right? Yeah. Whereas with Trump, who is in some respects nature less, he's, you know, he's not for or against anything. He just doesn't care. He's just there. But this has this superpower to sort of change everybody else's nature. How does this work? I mean, how do these people get sucked in? You make references throughout the book, you know, at various times about, you know, sort of the cultish nature of all of this. But yeah. There's some kind of trigger, dude. I mean, you just don't wake up if you're Marco Rubio, who has, you know, or Ted Cruz, and you're going battling, or Lindsey Graham, for God's sakes. And all of a sudden go, you know, from this guy's an asshole to I want to be his asshole.
Yeah, man. There is a chicken and egg element to it. This is how I'd answer it, right? I think that slowly it got corrupted over time. I don't, you know, we'd have to get a historian to put their finger on, like, you know, kind of what the tipping point was. But there's always game elements to politics, right? Yes. But there was this balance, okay? There's this balance in all things, right? Like George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, I mean, had Lee Atwater. You know, they ran some nasty ads. But he also knew that when he was going to govern, he was going to be the president for everybody, even the people that didn't vote for him, right? And he had this deep sense of I have a responsibility, right? And so, you know, there are these...
So that part of the game is get me in the room. That's the get me in the room part of the game.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But oh yeah, sure. It is.
Yeah. Because once I'm in the room, I'm going to govern as and then president I'll be good. A certain way, but I need to get in the room. So if I need Lee Atwater to get me in the room, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But then I'm going to be there. I understand I have this responsibility. This is not to excuse the Lee Atwater ads. I'm just saying that there's this balance, right? There's this balance, right? Of like, there's a competition and a responsibility. slowly over time in my era in particular, by the time I come around in the aughts, like the responsibility side of this is starting to wane. You know, you got McCain out there as sort of, you know, your last gasp of this a little bit. But we get all the things you just listed off. That just is part of the culture. It's just like, you know, politics has become more of a competition. Some of it is because of the media changes. Some of it's because of all these movies and the West, you know what I mean? And just the nature of the types of people going there. And so it's a snowball. And I just think it starts to get out of control. And by the time we're on the cusp of Trump coming in 2015-14, the culture in Republican politics is like that responsibility element is gone, right? And like all we care about is the competition and the game element, okay? And so if we have to be a little bit shady to win, that's fine. Like, who cares? Right. Like, this is all we care about because I don't have any responsibility. I'm not a public servant. Obama's been in there for 7 years. I'm not going to go into office. So I think that like debased mindset of the game allowed someone like Trump to come in and co-opt these people. And that's my answer to the question, right? Would Lindsey have been corruptible like that in 1998? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe this is at his core to human. But I think that this culture like got all of them very comfortable. And the jump to Trump was a lot smaller than it might have seemed in the past, because like this guy is just like, he's fucking good at the game. Like, say what you want about Trump. He's good at owning the libs. He's good at trolling his enemies. He's good at working the media. And now they're getting their comeuppance. So it's hard to get inside someone's head and say, well, what different circumstances in, but I do think that this over time got worse and worse and sort of laid the groundwork for Trump.
All right, we're having a conversation with my buddy Tim Miller about his new book, We Did It. It's
why we did it.
Why we did it. Yeah,
we didn't do it.
Yeah, we didn't. I'm sorry. You know what? That's a fair point. I must admit. No, you got me on that one. The book is Why We Did It. It's out now. It's a great read. Everyone's got to grab a copy of it. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. We're going to break down some of the characters that Tim decided to have a little conversation about right after this.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do, on a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news, weird politics, weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and I'm having a conversation with my buddy Tim Miller and his new book, Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. It is out. It is wonderful. And it is, as I said from the beginning, it really takes a microscope to some of the players who put in motion and kept in motion a lot of what we saw unfold over the last 5 years with Trump, and even in some respects still to this day. One of the aspects of this that I thought was very interesting was, and we were talking about before we went to break, the game itself and how that's played. And you quote in here, from one of the person who taught me the ropes at the Republican National Campaign School. He said, the highest praise one political operative can give another is that they get it. Get it is in quotations, raising concerns about downstream harm that might be caused by proposed political gambit is one of the best signs that you don't get it. and as we were going to break, you touched on that. You sort of lay out that line had blurred, where the concern about the impact of what was being done was less controlling. Because as I would, from my own experience with some of these people and from reading this, interpret it as it was a better part of the game to lean further into those that political gambit, regardless of its consequences, as long as I could realize an upside or a benefit. Yeah. That to me was ultimately Reince Priebus. I can share with you, and we'll start now with the chapter on Reince, which is called The Little Mix. And I can tell you, there were so many points in here where when you confronted him and he was trying to explain away, and every time you saw him thereafter, always kind of bringing back up, wanting to get you to agree with his rationale for sticking with Trump and promoting this bullshit, reminded me of my conversation with him of why he stabbed me in the back as national chairman and plotted for 4 or 5 months to run against me, all the while sitting in my I'm taking his counsel, he's hearing my thoughts about things and not being honest enough, but then trying to rationalize it. You don't understand, Michael, you couldn't win. I'm like, Reince, how do you know that? Right. You don't know what kind of campaign I was prepared to run. Cause I didn't, once I figured it out, I wasn't telling him everything. But there is this need.
That's just really quick. That's so good because that's so evident right now. Like, well, you just know you can't say January 6th was bad because you can't win. It's
right.
Like, well, how do you guys know that? Like, has anyone tried?
Exactly.
Like, maybe somee should try.
Maybe you should try. Yeah, just give it a thought. Maybe you should try. But it is very interesting to me how, you know, these pieces, kind of fill out the characters of these folks. And you say here, here's what actually you're talking about. As it turns out, my gut was right and the leaks missed a key part of the exchange. Reince didn't volunteer that he thought Trump should drop out. This has to do when the whole thing blew up with the
Access Hollywood.
And I had a flashback to Kevin McCarthy when I read this. So Reince goes out and makes it looks like he tried to get Trump to stop and then told Trump that if you do this, you know, you're going to lose. Oh, my God. It'll be the worst thing ever. And you go, here's actually what happened. Reince gave that threatening answer in response to a question that Trump, ever the narcissist, asked of him often. What are people saying about me? And so in his most storied moment of defiance, it turns out Reince was merely reporting what he was hearing, what the swampy chattering class was saying. It was still in the mix. In other words, Reince didn't tell Trump that as chairman of the National Party, I'm telling you, you need to sit your ass down because if you don't, we're going to lose and you're going to lose horrifically.
Right.
What Reince told him was, oh, what people are saying is if you don't sit down, you're going to lose. And it reminded me of Kevin McCarthy, who told his caucus, I'll tell Trump that, you know, January 6th was a bad thing and we have a problem here. In fact, no, he never did tell his caucus that. He just told his caucus he was going to say that. And it is one of the central elements of this sort of this type of character who is so full of wanting to be in the room and self-preservation that they're willing to create these fantastical scenarios in which they protect themselves. So I'm gonna just shade it by half. I'm not gonna tell you what I think. I'm gonna tell you what other people think, but I'm gonna tell everybody, this is what I told you I thought. How does that work?
The phrase that I would use, I forget if I use this phrase in the book, was the turd in the punch bowl. You know a little bit about being the turd in the punch bowl at the RNC.
Indeed.
It's like why you got pushed out in a big way. It is hard to be the turd in the punch bowl. It just is. So this is not a defense of the Kevin McCarthy's and the Reince's, but if you want to be in the mix, if you want to show that you get it, being right. the turd in the punch bowl is not the way to do that.
It's not
you
know, the way
be,
to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, being the person to say, this isn't right, this isn't proper, this isn't appropriate, you know, you become the school marm, right? Not and so, you know, in order, one of my reflections in this book that I hope is a good lesson for people in other industries, not just politics, is like, actually, sometimes you need to be the turd in the punch bowl, right? Like it requires it or else nothing
well, that's what leaders do.
Nothing's gonna happen. Exactly.
Good leaders are at times the turd in the punch bowl.
Yeah, yeah, because you're just telling people what they want to hear, you know, is a way just to continue down this same path that we've been down. So, no, that's right. It's funny you say all that about Reince, Michael. I didn't tell you this before we got on the podcast. So we'll just do it live here. But I did have like Reince stabbing you in the back in the chapter. So I can send you the director's cut of the chapter. But, you know, with editors, like, we just want to, editors, like, the stories about Reince going along with Trump. Like, and just how pathetic and toadying he is. He's like, you made your point. He's like, we don't. He's like, we also don't need this whole backstory about how he did the same thing 8 years earlier. So I'll send you the director's cut just for your own files.
Right. Yeah,
for the steel archives.
Right. It'll be nothing if not cathartic for me.
That's, I'll send it to you.
You know, but it does speak, Tim, to sort of the way you lay out these individuals in the book. You know, the chapter portion where you're talking about Donald Trump's errand boy, Chris Christie.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the Christie type character that you have. In fact, and what I found interesting, just as a prequel to what we're about to talk about, you very expertly you divide Trump supporters into categories. You have messiahs and junior messiahs, demonizers, LOL, nothing matters, Republicans, tribalist trolls, strivers, little mixes, Reince's, Peter Principle disprovers, nerd revengers,
Sean Spicer,
the inert team players, the compartmentalizers, cartel cashers. As we talk about some of these people, put them in the appropriate bucket that you see them in. Chris Christie, you go after. You said Donald Trump's errand boy, Chris Christie, has enough self-awareness to explain the compulsions of this mindset better than Reince ever could. In an interview with the Dispatch aimed at resuscitating his political career, the Republicans reek. Dude.
I just got to throw a little bon mots in there to keep people.
Oh, my God, you did. Relayed a piece of advice that he had given to a fellow governor who was approaching the end of his term. I said to him, look at one of the things you need to know. Look, one of the things you need to know is the music stops. Like, you watch your successor get sworn in. The troopers take you back to your house. You wake up the next morning and they're gone. And the cameras are gone. And the phone calls stop. And the music stops. And you got to figure out that, okay, what do I substitute in for that? Well, my wife disabused me of that after I got, you know, out of office and left the lieutenant governorship. You know what she said to me the next morning?
Yeah.
Well, baby, I think you need to get a job.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So in other words, you're so much in the game and want to be so much a part of the game that those things become the things that matter.
Yeah. And the key thing to this in this Christie example, which is why I thought that interview was just so telling, is like the music stopping, that he needs to fill. It wasn't like, oh man, being governor, I felt so fulfilling that I was able to help, you know, the school kids, and like we improved, you know, the math scores.
Right.
Like the music stopped that he's talking about is the lights, the cameras, the being in the room. And so Christie is two of these categories, right? And he is both the little messiahs, where like he thinks that he's going to be the big savior for the party. And you know, he has this messiah complex, and he also is like Reince, a little mix. He's a big mix, I guess.
Right.
And so Christie's mindset is just kind of the Uber version of what Reince was telling me, which is that like it was so important to get that rush. Like, there's an addictive quality to this desire to be in the room. People don't really, I think, appreciate that who aren't in Washington. You know, if you're a dentist out there with a real respectable job, you know, in Peoria, it might seem kind of like, is this really like, you're not a celebrity, you're not a famous person, like, you know, this isn't Justin Bieber, right? But there is that element to it, just that drug of access, being around power, the cameras, the limelight, the competition, you know, it all just is intoxicating. And Christie like basically just admits it on the record. It's just so embarrassing, but it is in that world we inhabited, Michael, that is so acceptable to talk about that he kind of just admits this embarrassing thing on the record, which is that like he was so addicted to the limelight that he went and sidled up to Donald Trump.
But how do
you? And Chris Christie could have done anything with his life.
Absolutely, like absolutely.
He's a very talented person, right?
Yeah.
Trump's butt boy was what he chose, but no, that's how he got that juice. That's how he got that juice that the lights turned off. That's how he turned the lights back on.
But so like driving around with Donald Trump. Does that explain Ted Cruz sitting there allowing Donald Trump calling his wife ugly? And because a number of neighborhoods, you call out a man's wife like that. Oh, hell no, baby. Your ass is in my sling at that point. I'm standing on that debate stage and you're going to do that. And you're going to talk about my family. If I'm Jeb Bush, about my brother and my father, are you fucking kidding me? When did these guys become such pussies to the point that they can't even stand up in it, which is so ironic when you listen to Josh Hawley talk about, you know, Republican manhood today.
Oh my God, the Republican manhood initiative. You know how I know it describes Ted Cruz? Because he's got a big podcast now. This is what he wants. He wants the attention. He wants the love from this. Look, Jeb, my man Jeb, right, who I worked for, he's got a great life right now. He's down in Miami. Right. He goes to church in the morning. He plays golf. He's got a few clients. He plays with his grandkids. It is a wonderful, fulfilling life. Ted Cruz looks at that life and he's like, the music's off. Music's turned off for Jeb. And I'm not ready for that. I'm a young man. I still want the music to be on for me. And so it does explain it. He might tell himself that the reason that he did it was because of the judges or whatever. It wasn't that, man. Ted Cruz, like, that's why if it was because of the judges and because of the policy, Ted Cruz would have put his head down, been a good legislator, would have tried to get policies that he thought were right passed. He didn't do any of that, man. He's a Twitter troll and a podcast host now. He likes to have in the staff and he likes having the limelight. That's all. It's pathetic, but that's all it is.
When does a U.S. senator have time to be a podcast host?
He gets pretty good ratings. I don't know. You know, I mean,
these people pitched a bitch when I was national chairman because I wrote a book on how to defeat Barack Obama's agenda.
Oh yeah. No, sorry. That was too much, Michael. I think we kind of know why that was a particular problem for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. But man, no, that's where we are now.
We talked about the 168, which is the 168 members of the Republican National Committee, comprised of national chairman, committee man, committee woman. One of those individuals whom we both know very well, because not just the legacy of the Barber family with Haley Barber, former RNC chairman and governor of Mississippi, but Henry Barber.
Yeah.
It was very interesting when you talked about, you know, you know, Barbara was a charter member of the Privately Concerned. talk to us about Barbara as a representation of the Privately Concerned.
I'm happy we could do this one, but other people haven't asked me about Henry, so we can talk about this on this podcast because he's an interesting character, man. Here's the thing about Henry and why he was an interesting case study. He's the same as us. Not in our character necessarily, but I just, as far as his view of Donald Trump is indistinguishable from Michael Steele's or mine. And he went a different route. Why? Okay. Why? There are some of these people that went along with Trump and then started to like him. You know, this is not Henry. If Henry caught me at a tailgate, I write about this. I just bumped into him at a tailgate. And all he wanted to do is talk in my ear about how terrible Trump is and how terrible the party's going and blah, blah, right? Like that's where his head is at. He's a bulwark listener, you know?
Maybe not
anymore after the
book. But he was, and
in some ways I'm sympathetic to it because it's like, okay, this is a person that is a real person, a three-dimensional person that sees Donald Trump for who he is, but he's tormented by it a little bit almost, you know, but he's like, okay, I got my job. I got my family name. I got my kids. Like, my kids are going to college now. Like, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And there are things you could do. You can do what your wife suggested you. You can just go get a real man's job and go get out of politics. Right. But so he does all these things to kind of rationalize it. He compartmentalizes. He's a cartel casher. He's making money. And you know, he tries to help the good Republicans to help make him feel better. So he kind of uses all of these different rationalizations to sort of just get to stay around and stay around and stay around. And then occasionally his, like, that conscience, like what he knows, his core seeps out. This happened after January 6th when the committee tried to, put a resolution
against
Cheney and Adam Kinzinger.
Right.
Henry Barber was one of the few people who put his name up on that in 168 and said, no, this is stupid. Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney are still Republicans.
Right.
So this notion, you know, this belief within him that he sees things the way we do seeps out from time to time. And he showed, I think, more moral strength than some of the other people in this book who don't say anything. But like when push comes to shove, these rationalizations are just still so powerful, like whether it's money, whether it's identity, whether it's being on the team, all that stuff kind of overwhelms the doing the right thing and doing a clean break, which is scary and hard.
So that I found how you've just described him to be very consistent with my experience with him. I've always liked Henry.
Me too. Me too.
I still do in a weird way. I haven't talked to Henry since I left the RNC, but I always had this feeling, and you put it aptly, that there was a good connection there, that we were on the same page. And when I was chairman, in many respects, we were. But I could also see that there was enormous amount of pressure for him to conform to the trend line that was working against me, because, you know, I did some things that really pissed off a number of these categories you have here. Certainly
the cartel cashers, they didn't like you very much.
The cartel cashers, baby. They were so pissed at me. I mean, my first 2 weeks on the job, I killed about $20 million worth of contracts. And they were, I was told later, you don't know how much trouble you were in when you did that. Because they thought Michael Duncan, who was the former chairman, who ran again, they thought he was going to be chairman. And they'd
be their meal ticket.
They'd be the meal ticket. And I came in and went, nope, we're not doing that. And Henry was one of those guys that liked that.
Yeah.
He liked that I came in and cleaned up. He was part of this growing number of RNC members who were upset about the grift that the RNC had sort of fallen into because it was impacting their states.
Right.
The money was being diverted from the states to Washington that was then being dispensed around the country to a smaller group of players. Yeah. So I kind of broke that cabal up. But what struck me was Henry turned and became, he was one of those loud, they convinced him to be a loud advocate for my, you know, removal or my, you know, avoiding my reelection. Until I launched the Fire Pelosi trip, and this is when I knew, you know, exactly what you just described about him. I looked around that room knowing all these bastards were trying to screw me. And yet when I announced the Fire Pelosi tour, which nobody wanted me to do because they didn't want me to get out there in the country. They wanted to contain the narrative about me inside Washington.
Right.
Couldn't do it when I'm out in Arkansas, right? Yeah, right. And folks on the ground are going, we like this guy, right?
Yeah.
I looked around the room and there was Henry Barber. I'll never forget this image of him standing on his chair, whooping it up, so glad that we were going to take the fight to the Democrats on the ground in the backyards of America, right? Yeah. Put the Fire Pelosi cap on, waving the T-shirt, whooping it up, whooping it hard. I'm like, dude, you're part of the cabal to get rid of me, and I'm bringing this shit to you guys. So you could see where that dividing line in the conflict for a lot of these guys was. On the one hand, they liked the idea of engaging in the fight in a legitimate way you know, to put our principles and our values and our positions out there. But then there was this inside Washington, the cartel cashers, the, you know, the various, you know, levels of groups, the little mixes, all these players who had their little corner that you wanted to be in the room with.
Yeah. And he is, he's a team player. Look, it's in his name. It's in his blood. He's a team player. This
he's
is
a team player. Yeah.
And this is like ties back to the gay stuff, the identity stuff. Like, man, for Henry Barber to go do what we did, like that would have taken even more gumption, right? Because then it's like, man, I'm going out against my family. I'm going out against my bloodline. I'm going against my money. I'm going out against my friends, all of this, you know? So in the end, you're a team player. And I think that's how I ended that chapter. Like in the end, he's a team player. And that's just like, that's just it. And so, you know, that is, it's not a compliment or criticism really. Like that's just reality. And so like he had this element within him that could have been drawn, I think, to the right place, but he just kept getting sucked back in with the team. And I think that your story that shows that was true of him back then too.
Yeah,
it's the same
yeah.
thing, even pre-Trump, right? Like, if it was like, okay, well, if the team's going to get together for a Fire Pelosi thing, I'm going to put on the team hat.
Right. But
it's like, oh man, but if the team needs to get rid of this guy and replace him with somebody else, I'm going to be part of that. Right. You know right. what I mean? Like it's a conformity. This is the high school cafeteria of life analysis
so
of these
well,
guys, man.
So well put. And Lord knows, you know, I've had my share of sodas dropped on my feet. So before I let you get out of here, I do want to touch on one last piece of this, and that is conservative media, because that to me has been one of the more interesting transformative aspects of this narrative. One part of the book where you sort of touch on this is the Junior Messiah and the OG demagogues. You talk about WorldNet Daily and all of that. Where does conservative media fit into this narrative about how we did it?
Hugely, hugely critical.
And why we did it.
Yeah, hugely, hugely critical. And one of the things that I cut out in addition to the Michael Steele story is just like getting really deep on the conservative media stuff. Maybe this is a follow-up book, but it started to drag down the story a little bit.
Right.
So I'll give you the director's cut on both of those. But the short of it is this, man. What it turns out, the conservative media members like to think of themselves as being the principled policy types. And there are a handful of them out there. Okay. There's some principled policy types out there.
Right.
As it turns out, they're just part of the same cabal, the same game, the same cartel. I wrote about all this. It's like Breitbart used to have me over to the Breitbart embassy and all us establishment guys and big Republican donors who paid for big Republican campaigns would fund their little parties. Right. And it's like, is this media? This isn't media. Yeah. And everybody'd be there. The Daily Caller guys would be there and the National Review guys would be there. And, you know, we'd all trade stories. And, you know, I wrote about, I think this ended up getting cut from the book, but I was like, the donors for my group, America Rising, which was this opposition research group I started, were the same as the donors to the Free Beacon and to like these other things. And so it's like, so the Free Beacon is writing about the research that we created at America Rising. Is that journalism or is that just my colleague doing me a solid, right? That's my colleague
right.
doing me a solid. And they're the same donors that donate to the NRSC, by the way, you know? And so should it have been surprising then that actually all these guys just submitted to the Donald Trump mob and to the Donald Trump team? Like, of course not, because they're just members of the team. They're not
right.
Like with the few exceptions, we can all name them, you know, your Steve Hayes, your Jonah Goldberg, your George Wills, like they're a handful. Crystal, obviously, my man, Bill Crystal. Like there are a few people who had principles, but it shouldn't be surprising that the vast, vast majority of these people just went along with all of it because, and Fox, you know, it's all part of just this same kind of the same game and the same grift. And like, they just put a kind of a journalistic sheen on it. But in reality, it wasn't really any different than what was happening on the campaign side. And so I ended up doing just one chapter on that, just to kind of give a little peek behind the curtain for folks so they understand how simpatico it is. And then the other element really quick is how simpatico they were in creating these grievances, these kind of fake grievances that drove people into Trump's arms, right? Like, you know, we're all on the same page.
If we're running
negative ads about how Hillary is the devil, and they're running articles about how Hillary has a kill list, and, you know, we're all running, and I'm giving them little tips about how Hillary fell over, and so she's probably old, right? Like, of all of that is part of the same ecosystem. And we were all kind of delivering it tongue in cheek, not all of us, but I'm just saying, as a general matter, people, the Washington political class, Conservatism Inc., as JBL calls it, was delivering it to these voters with a tongue in cheek. This is the game. This is how you did a win. This is what you need to do. But the voters weren't seeing this as a game. The readers weren't seeing it as a game. They were seeing all this stuff and going, man, these people are evil.
Right.
And so should it be really surprising then that they would have turned to the guy who was the best at tarring them as evil? I don't think so. And so, no, I think that it's all part and parcel of the same story, and all the rationalizations are the same. And you know, you could do a whole nother book just about the conservative media side of things.
I think particularly given the role that you played at the RNC from a communication standpoint, and we didn't get a chance to talk about, because there's some funny stuff. I love when you were talking about, for example, the fundraising part, and you were bitching about the letters that they were sending to old ladies. I had the exact same argument with the finance department.
Did you?
Exact.
That's what I'm talking about. That's really good. Just for 1 minute, so people understand,
exact,
who are listeners.
Same these argument.
Mailers. The RNC sends out these mailers to old people, and they're insane. It's hyperbole. It's about how the world is ending. They're begging people for money, and it's all this fake BS and nonsense. And I'd try to edit them and make them a little bit more, at least tethered to reality. And they refused. You know, they're just like, why? What? Why would we change this? It's working. This is how we're getting our money.
We raise our money.
And I
had my finance team, I brought them into my office, and they always send the letter up to the chairman to sign off on it, right?
Yeah.
And they did. And I read it. And so I called in Reince, I called in McKay, my chief of staff, the finance chair, director. And the political director, and we sat there and I looked at this. This was a 9.5-page letter that they were sending out. And I said, well, first off, who the hell's going to read a 9.5-page letter? I said, secondly, all this crap you've got in here. I said, you know what? We're not sending this out. I'm not sending this out under my signature. I want a 1-page letter. I want 1 page. And in that one page, I don't want you to, you know, go into all this hyperbole. I just want you to tell, this is what we're doing, and this is why we need your dollars. And you can give us a dollar, you can give us $1,000, but this is it. 1 page. You would have asked them, I told them to rewrite the Ten Commandments.
I'm telling you, I got, that's hilarious. I got pulled up into the chairman's office, had the same meeting. But in my case, it was, the chairman was on the side of just sending it out. They're like, who's this fucking deputy communications director trying to change this 9.5-page letter that we've been sending out from time immemorial?
Right.
But I was like, this is nuts.
It is nuts. But you realize, and that was part of the grift, that was sending this stuff to frighten these elderly people who are the mainstays of their donors, and try to get them to, you know, agree to keep that, you know, credit card open with $5 a month on it for whatever reason. And you just realize that you're just taking advantage of people, because you're not delivering shit.
Right.
We are a political operation, right? And particularly given one of the big problems, as you know, was the money was only going to maybe on a good day, 12 states,
right?
Because the other 38 states weren't players. Maryland wasn't a play for Republicans, right? California wasn't a play for Republicans. We tried to change that dynamic a little bit inside, but I'm sitting there going, well, you're raising money from all these people in these conservative states that we're not even doing anything on the ground with. Why? And that's why the state party chair operators were upset, because they saw, you know, the RNC would come in and do a fundraiser. You know how this goes. They would do a fundraiser, and they would tell the state, all right, well, we'll get 75% of that. You keep 25%.
Right.
If that,
that's a good deal. Yeah, I was going to say 90-10 maybe. 90-10
was typically. So what I did is I came in and I said, all right, look, I tell you what, we'll raise money for you, right? Depending on their financial situation, we'll split it 50-50.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you keep 75%, we take 25%. Because I know I'm doing this in seven other states. Right. So, you know, I'm going to make the money that we need. But it all goes to what you outline in the book, how all these elements play into the overarching narrative of what we saw play out over the last, during the Trump years for certain, and how actually much easier it was, Tim, for people to fall into this Trumpian trap, because in many respects, they were already engaged in a lot of this behavior. And
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's why it's we, unfortunately, not why, they.
And that's why it's we. Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell, author Tim Miller. Thank you so much, my friend, for being a part of the conversation. I really appreciate it. I thank you. I probably took more time than I've told you.
No, Michael, this has been awesome. We had too much fun. I started talking about the old RNC days, and you know, it's just good. It's like a couple guys at a bar after a while telling old war stories. So this was enjoyable. I appreciate it, man.
Unfortunately, those war stories have a real impact on real people. And,
yeah.
And that's why I appreciate Why We Did It, because we're all culpable in sort of putting in place these ugly narratives, and it is refreshing to hear and to read the truth about what happened and how it happened, why it happened, and what you do is expose people to that side of the conversation with a level of clarity. I think it's important, and I appreciate you.
Thanks so much, man. I appreciate you.
All right, folks, that does it for our conversation this time. Really appreciate Tim coming in. Thanks for listening. You can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele, as always, or the podcast Twitter at Steele_podcast. Don't forget to check out Tim and the great work he's doing over at The Bulwark. You can follow him on Twitter at TimODC. He's a good brother, and it's a great read. Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. Pick up a copy, read it, because it gets you, like I said, up the ass with a microscope of some of these folks and why they do what they do, folks. Really appreciate it. Until next time, be safe. Enjoy summer.